Hey, this is the time set for oral argument in Kimmins versus State. And as you can see, we've got part of the court in Las Vegas, part of it in Carson City. You will have the clock running in Carson City and each side gets 17 minutes. The first 2 minutes are your territory to talk without interruption from the justices. And after that, game is on and we can ask questions. So with that, could counsel for the appellant, Catherine Reynolds, please tell us how much time you want to reserve for rebuttal, and we'll get underway.
Thank you, Justice Pickering. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes, please.
Very well.
May it please the court. Mr. Kimmins maintains his innocence. The most inculpatory evidence admitted against him in this case was his own statement to Amanda McCall, his girlfriend, that, "I hope your parents have marshmallows." The timing of this comment was critical. If it was made after the fire was started, after it was clear to everyone in South Reno that there was a fire in the Galena area, it was not necessarily inculpatory. It was nasty. It was unnecessary. But it did not indicate, that Mr. Kimmins had set this fire. Now, on the other hand, if the comment was made before it was common knowledge or before a fire had been set, then yes, this comment could be interpreted as incriminating. In this case, Amanda herself placed the comment after she saw the smoke. Glenn Inslee, on the other hand, was the most significant witness for the state to testify that the comment was made prior to the fire. Mr. Kimmins was not inquired at trial was not permitted at trial to inquire into the full extent of bias that Mr. Inslee had against him. Mr. Inslee had previously held Mr. Kimmins at gunpoint. He did not like Mr. Kimmins. He did not like that Mr. Kimmins was with Amanda. And his dislike, while that was on the record, the extent to which he had gone to express it before was not. This was a plain abuse of discretion and requires reversal. However, and I believe what this court is most interested to hear, Mr. Kimmins was also overcharged. Now, as relates to this argument with unit of prosecution, there was one fire that Mr. Kimmins was accused of setting at the Browns Creek trailhead. This fire burned one house, scorched two others, along with some of the bushes. It was charged as 3 counts of first-degree arson and a single count of third-degree arson. This is incorrect. It should be 1 count of first-degree arson with respect to the 3 houses burned and a single count of third-degree arson with respect to the bushes.
Is there a fifth charge that's something else?
There was one other fire. There was another brush fire that was separately located that was set that Mr. Kimmins was convicted of. It, as relates to the unit of prosecution argument, it is not relevant.
Thank you.
Recently, in Radonsky, this court reiterated that arson is a specific intent crime. It's not enough that a person willfully set a fire with the awareness that the fire could spread or is likely to cause harm. Rather, this court has indicated that it gives full effect to the statutory language that arson is both willful and malicious, that a fire is set with the specific intent to injure property that is harmed. In defining arson,
how do you square that with NRS 205045 in the contiguous fires statute, as it is sometimes artfully called?
So, with respect to the contiguous fire statute, I'd note as a preliminary matter that that language has been unchanged since the statute was enacted in 1911. It's also grammatically a little bit of a nightmare. The language itself, with respect to first-degree arson, or any of the arsons, the word at issue here is any, and whether any encompasses single or all. Now, the contiguous fires provision first discusses any building or structure which may be the subject of arson, again, which this court has interpreted to require specific intent, is manifestly endangered by any fire and shall be set on fire by any person participating in the setting of such fire shall be deemed to have participated in building or setting the structure on fire. First, the building itself is the subject of the arson. That's unclear with respect to intent, which building that statute is referring to. Second, there are multiple interpretations of NRS 205-045. The first suggests that this could, the use of any people and any fire suggests that this could apply to a situation where multiple people set multiple things on fire. There's a conflagration, and it suggests joint and several liability for those crimes. It also serves to establish liability. Again, this was enacted in 1911. In an instance where somebody sets an outbuilding, such as a barn or a shed, on fire, that would be second-degree arson under the statute. If that house catches on fire as a result of the fire to the outbuilding, then that would be a, that would again be a first-degree arson. So I don't think, by no means do I think that the contiguous fires provision is the deciding factor here. As discussing with respect to first-degree arson, it applies to any dwelling house or structure, whether owned by the defendant or another. So both. You can set your own house on fire. Any of those structures, to set those willfully and maliciously on fire, you are guilty of arson. This court has previously recognized that the use of the word any is problematic, can be problematic in statutory interpretation. In Martinez, this court examined Nevada's prohibited person in possession of a firearm statute, which provides that a ex-felon may not have custody or control of any firearm. The court determined that any was ambiguous. It can mean one. It can mean one, some, or all. It can mean all. And in making the decision that the ex-felon permitted one charge, regardless of number of firearms seized in any given time and place, this court looked to us a couple things. First, the rule of lenity, that the state could only charge the one violation because, absent clear expression of legislative intent to the contrary, the presumption is of the court is that the legislature does not intend to create multiple punishments for the same offense. Again, in Castaneda, this court found the use of any to be ambiguous, finding that possession of any film or photograph depicting a sexual portrayal of a minor relates to all images simultaneously possessed, not a separate punishment for each image. And use of any also becomes interesting when you look at the arson statutes together, especially with respect to the reading of third-degree arson, which uses the term any to prohibit the burning of any unoccupied personal property of another, which has the value of $25 or more, any timber, forest, shrubbery, crops, grass, or vegetation. Now, within these categories, it seems clear that if a person were to set fire to a pile of crates, each crate which is worth $25, that should be one third degree arson. That's not, if there were 10 crates in the pile, that's not 10. As noted in the briefing, other jurisdictions that have looked at this issue have notably reached very mixed results. The defense would urge this court to look towards State versus Westing, which was a Washington case in 2002. In that case, the Washington Supreme Court determined that where three cars, where there was one car that was set on fire, three cars ultimately burned, this was one arson. Some things of note, though, statute at issue in Westing is very similar to Nevada's in that it requires that the fire be both knowing and malicious, and that it damage any structure, automobile, or other motor vehicle. The Washington Supreme Court there said the use of the word any means every and all, and that the injury is only stated in terms of property damage, not amount or number, very similar to Nevada. Similarly, in State v. Lewis, the Supreme Court of Tennessee found that when a fire was set in an apartment building, that was one arson for the single structure, not for each apartment or dwelling within that building. I recognize that there are some cases that go the other way, but I would submit to the court that these are all distinguishable.
In State v. Buchanan, which was out of Kansas in 2023, the court, in direct opposition to Lewis, found one fire set in an apartment building, multiple apartments, multiple counts of arson. However, what would distinguish Buchanan is that in that case, Mr. Buchanan was charged with arson by means of fire damaging a property, and that at the time of the fire, there was a human being in the property, and the fire resulted in the substantial risk of bodily harm. So in that case, the court found, again, that the mens rea was different, first of all. It was general versus specific intent. And there was a distinguisher that another person needed to be present in the property. The court in Buchanan, when looking at what Kansas has as a lesser arson statute, which related to dwellings, specifically declined to expand its reasoning or consider whether those separate whether its allowing of one unit of prosecution in this case would relate to a situation when it was simply property damage, the dwellings that were unoccupied.
Has there ever been any, are there other states that have a contiguous fire statute or anything, whether it's labeled that or not, that resembles ours?
Not that I have found in my research, Justice Pickering, and I did look. I think that appears to be unique.
Do you know what the origin of that statute is? I mean, I understand I can read the numbers at the bottom of the page, but do you know what the
I know that it was enacted with many other provisions of the criminal code in 1911, and there is very little legislative history.
Yeah, it appears to be a unique statute. I don't know. I mean, I just was wondering if you found anything different.
Not in my research, and I did try. Mm-hmm. Similarly, I would distinguish Commonwealth versus Pennsylvania, which was a similar count where the Pennsylvania Supreme Court upheld four counts of arson where there were four police officers inside a building at the time a fire was lit. Again, that is relating to a statute that punished a person intentionally starting a fire and recklessly placing another person in danger of death or bodily injury. And in upholding that statute, the court again looked to Pennsylvania's reckless endangerment statute as the fact that the multiple victims were people to uphold the multiple counts of arson. Finally, the other most notable case disfavorable or where the court has found that multiple counts of arson could stand would be Magana v. People, and that's out of Colorado in 2022. The statutory structure of Colorado's arson statute is very similar to Nevada. First degree dwelling, second degree other structure or property, third degree brush fires or personal property. But there are some very key differences in the statute. The first is that the Colorado statute relates to general intent. There is not a specific intent statute in Colorado. And second, the Colorado statutes also relate to the property of another in defining arson. Arson has to be the property of another, unlike Nevada, where it can be the property of the defendant himself or another. And I think that's key. And so there they're saying that clearly that use of just another, that defines the victim as a property owner, whereas here there is not that definition in the Nevada statute. Ultimately, Mr. Kimmons would submit that lenity requires that any ambiguity in the statute defining a crime or imposing a penalty should be resolved in a defendant's favor. As it relates to these charges, Mr. Kimmons was accused of setting the one brush fire, which ultimately caused three houses to be burned under the Nevada definition. And again, Mr. Simmons would submit that this should be a single count of first-degree arson with respect to the houses. Finally, I would be remiss if I didn't address the cross-examination of Mr. Inslee. As I discussed at the beginning, the district court excluded the fact that Mr. Inslee had previously pointed a gun at Mr. Kimmons and threatened him. And the language of the district court said simply that because it was a prior crime and when it was a prior bad act, it was automatically inadmissible. This was not the case. It is not Nevada's law with respect to prior bad acts or bias. And Mr. Kimmons would submit that it requires reversal. I would reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Jennifer Noble, and I represent the state of Nevada. Of course, in this case, we are asking this court to affirm all of the convictions underlying this trial. But in particular, we are asking this court to rule that where a defendant sets fire willfully and maliciously in an area where structures are manifestly endangered, NRS 205.045 permits one count of first-degree arson per structure set fire to within the meaning of NRS 205.005. To be guilty of first-degree arson, a defendant has to willfully and maliciously set fire to or cause to burn a dwelling house, structure, etc. And in response to this court's question in the order for argument, 205.005 informs our analysis by defining set fire to for purposes of that second element. Whenever any part of a structure is scorched, charred, or burned, it has been set fire to. And that's exactly what happened to three homes in this case. Now, Nevada's contiguous fire statute appears to be unique. And like Ms. Reynolds, I did look for legislative history, and I was told by the legislative history librarians that it would be tough to find that these 1911 Criminal Crimes and Punishments Act, we wouldn't really be able to find much that would illuminate stuff for our purposes here today. But it reads, and I think it shows that it was written in 1911, whenever any building or structure which may be the subject of arson in either the first or second degree shall be so situated as to be manifestly endangered by any fire and shall be subsequently set on fire thereby, any person participating in the setting of such fire shall be deemed to have participated in setting such building or structure on fire. Now, interestingly, in looking at law review articles, trying to find something on our contiguous fire statute, I did find something from 1986, Missouri Law Review, and it talked about how this concept is actually not new, this unique contiguous fire statute that we appear to have in Nevada. It actually harkens back to common law, the 1500s, and the concept of wanton arson. Now, the Radonsky case clarified the definition of maliciously as it applied to first-degree arson. It distinguished our definition in Nevada from California's. In Nevada, we have to show evil intent, an intent to cause harm. But the evidence of malice in this case is overwhelming. A couple of examples. The locations in which these two fires were set, both of them close to fuel tanks. The fire that destroyed the homes was set on a brush that was just on the end of a cement driveway near several homes, and that's at volume 5 of the record, 667 to 676, I believe. It's near a fuel tank, and it was determined that it was caused by open flame placed on a bush. Mr. Kimmons' acknowledgement when he's setting the second fire to a passing jogger that bitter brush in this area, which is all, these two fires are within a mile of each other, less than that. But he says that that bitter brush there is the stuff that really burns. His statements to the same jogger that as an outdoorsman, he understood the danger of fires in Nevada. His fight with his girlfriend earlier that day, followed by his comment about hoping that her parents, quote, had marshmallows up there when she said she was going to go stay with them. And the proximity of all these fires to the McCall residents. They're all in the same neighborhood, just a couple, the houses that are damaged are just a few houses down or even one lot away. Now,
counsel, how do you square your interpretation of the unit of prosecution with our decision in Castaneda?
Thank you for the question, Justice Lee. So in Castaneda, this court explained that in deciding the unit of prosecution where the statute is ambiguous, it turns to related statutes, legislative history, and prior interpretations of similar statutes. And then after all those legitimate tools of interpretation have been exhausted and reasonable doubt is still there, then the rule of lenity applies. And in that case, the court looked carefully at NRS 200.700.760, trying to find out the appropriate unit of prosecution for child pornography. It found that the legislative history provided no insight with regard to any of the statutes in that chapter. And ultimately, because the legislative history and the statutes didn't help in interpreting the unit of prosecution, the rule of lenity was applied. We can apply that same approach in this case, but the big difference is Nevada's contiguous fire statute. Now it is written in a somewhat arcane way, but it operates to impute criminal liability when someone commits first or second degree arson, and it specifically incorporates that statute by reference, 205.010. It says that essentially that defendant is on the hook for first degree or second degree arson, whichever one is proven, for each structure that's burned, where it's obvious that these structures are manifestly endangered. Here we know that these houses were scorched or burned, set fire to within the meaning of the applicable statute. So the question is, well, was this willfully and maliciously? In addition to what I previously cited, I mean, looking at where these fires were set, et cetera, it demonstrates malice, but we can also look at the cases from other jurisdictions that this court called attention to.
But before you do that, though, I'd like to pause on Radonsky. It's state versus second judicial district court, but the defendant in that case was Radonsky, and that's our 2020 decision that talks about willfully and maliciously, and that our arson statute is a specific intent statute. It concerns me for your argument that these are multiple, that there are three first degree arsons here and not just one. The way in which we're discussing evil intent to harm or injure as separate and apart from and necessary for maliciously, it's separate and apart from willfully. So if you have to have the intent to harm by setting the fire and foreseeing its consequences, the intended harm in this case was burning down the girlfriend's father's house, and then the fire spread to the second and third houses. And I may have the facts a little wrong, but go with me on this just analytically. The willfully and maliciously would relate to setting a fire deliberately with the intent of harming the girlfriend's father's house. So that's a fait accompli with the scorching or burning of the first house, but how do you get maliciously for the second and third? Because there isn't any intent deliberately to harm those. The intent ran to the first house. Do you follow what I'm asking?
I think so, Justice Pickering, and I'll do my best to answer your question. So as I understand it, you're saying if we have malicious intent with regard to wanting to burn down the McCall home, how does that carry over to the other structures burned? And does that intent carry over? Do I understand
exactly
it right?
Exactly so.
Okay. So here I think it's important to note, I think that 205.045 actually informs that question still, because it's incorporating the first degree arson statute specifically. So when you set that fire, I don't think you have to have the intent to harm a specific residence. It's an intent to cause harm generally. And so he's setting these fires in an area that he tells people, I know it's very flammable here. I understand that this brush burns. He's setting these fires near fuel tanks, and he set the first one not even right outside the McCall residence. He actually set it, I believe, near the driveway, at the bottom of the driveway in some brush. And I don't believe, and I don't have the page number for you, but I don't believe that was even the McCall residence. So he's setting fires in the neighborhood.
You still need the willfully or maliciously. I mean, I don't think that if somebody says, help me build this campfire, and I don't know that the person's laid a gas trail from the campfire to an adjoining house, I think I could be held under 045 for having participated, but I don't know that I could get bagged for first or second degree arson, even though my colleague may have intended it and could be convicted. I mean, I think you're expanding that 205.045, which is people who help build the fire, but I think to be actually convicted, they would need to have their own willfully and maliciously. specific intent established to get up to first or second degree. And in fact, you need it for third degree too. It's just a question of what is the structure.
Thank you for the question. Our position here today is that if we were to accept the interpretation that you are proposing, that essentially, because 205.045 specifically incorporates first and second degree arson by reference, that would render that it would be pointless to even have that in the statute, and it would render it essentially nugatory when it comes to first and second degree arson. And here, there's no evidence that this person was trying to start campfires. This person was setting a fire in an area that was manifestly endangered. And this statute evinces basically an old concept, again, of wanton arson, where you are setting a fire, you are doing it in an area where you see that residences, dwelling homes, are manifestly endangered, and you do it anyway. And the intent at the time he set the fire was malicious. He set these fires above and below her parents' house, which was off of Joy Lake Road, with, I think, 3/4 of a mile of each other. He called and said, "I hope your parents have marshmallows," when he did it. And so our position is that 205.045 incorporates first-degree arson by reference, and an interpretation that would require a separate demonstration of malice with regard to each structure that catches on fire would essentially render that statute meaningless in a lot of ways, and there would be no reason for it to incorporate first and second-degree arson.
So, Ms. Noble, just to be clear, you acknowledge, I think, that for each count of first-degree arson, there would have to be a showing of willfulness and malice as required and as set forth in our Radonsky case. But I guess the question is, willfulness and malice as to, like, what? Does it need to be malice toward the owner or occupier of each separate dwelling, or what malice or willfulness do we need?
The willfulness and malice that you need is to cause harm, and it does not need to be directed at a specific person.
And right, so if I mean to set this person's on fire, this person's house on fire that I'm right in front of, and it ends up blowing down the street and sets two other homes on fire, your position is that I have met the malice and willfulness requirement, and the contiguous fires, I guess, help support that.
Yes, essentially, you engaged in this actus reus, and then the result is this resulting harm. And we have other areas of law where, you know, you might shoot one person, the bullet goes.
Like a transferred intent.
Exactly. It's almost like transferred intent, but because it was written in 1911, that's not what it says. But I think it is a similar concept. And really, public policy concerns, I think, would support that interpretation, because we're living in a state where we have to worry about fires all the time. We have to worry about naturally caused fires enough without letting defendants know that if they just set one fire, they can burn down as many houses as they want and get one count of arson. That would seem to not be a message we'd want to send, and there's nothing in the legislative intent that would support that. Ms. Reynolds.
So if you set a fire intentionally, and you mean to harm the first house that's burned, but then a high wind comes up and it rips through the forest and burns three more houses, you would say that would be 4 counts of first-degree arson?
I think we would, thank you for the question, Justice Pickering. I think we would need to show that under the circumstances in which the fire was set, those properties were manifestly endangered. So, If there could be an argument that the wind was something that couldn't be predicted, it was some sort of supervening or interceding or, you know, some sort of other act that couldn't be reasonably expected to happen, then the defendant might be able to argue that in order to avoid multiple counts. I think it depends on the factual circumstances and the area in which the fire was set. But here we're in a very dry area, right near homes, near a propane tank, 2 propane tanks in this case, both exploded. So these properties were manifestly endangered, and the way these fires were set was clearly with malice to not only endanger the McCall property, but the properties in the neighborhood. No reasonable person would think that they were only endangering one home.
But arguably, if like a unexpected gust of wind blew up and blew this, you know, blew an ember down 5 miles down the road, like, you know, Pasadena, then maybe, we don't know, I guess, potentially it would be established if they meet the 0.045 requirement that it was manifestly endangered.
Yes, I think it would be really fact-dependent on an individual case. With regard to the marshmallow comment and Mr. Ensley, 75-year-old Mr. Ensley, who at some point prior to the facts of this case, Mr. Ensley lived with the defendant and his girlfriend. And at some point, they moved out. When this case starts, they're all moved out. It's not clear from the record how remote in time that was. But what I do want to make clear is that if there was error, it was harmless, because there were many instances in this record in which the jury would have become aware that Mr. Ensley did not like Mr. Kimmons. For example, he testified, and they can see this at page 20 of the opening brief, that he did not like or trust Mr. Kimmons. He testifies further, and I don't have the volume number, I'm sorry, but around page 232, 300 to 301 of the record, that he saw Mr. Kimmons just walk into his apartment, tap a man on the head, and just walk out. So these prior incidents, in addition to his testimony that he won't even tell Mr. Kimmons where Amanda is on the day, the jury knew that Mr. Ensley did not like the defendant. Now, in terms of the timing of the take back the deck, or I'm sorry, not the take back the deck, that's a different issue, of the marshmallows comment. At the time, Mr. Ensley testifies that Amanda says to him, he threatened to burn down my parents' house, and she agreed about that. That was before the fire. However, there is also evidence to support that Amanda's account is less credible because she testifies at trial that he is still her boyfriend. She's in love with him. We also have jail calls, I believe, were transmitted, Exhibit 6. Those jail calls reveal that Mr. Kimmons is talking to Amanda about the importance of saying that the marshmallow comment happens after the fire. With regard to the, I have 16 seconds, with regard to the take back the deck comment, I would concede essentially because this occurred after the facts of this case that it may have been error for the court to admit this evidence. However, any error would have been harmless. May I finish my sentence?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you. Oh, sorry. Any error would have been harmless given the overwhelming evidence of the defendant's guilt in this case. We ask you to affirm and adopt the rule proposed by the state. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. Very briefly, with respect to Mr. Ensley, not liking someone is very different than not liking somebody so much that you will do something illegal, such as pull a gun on him. And that is the bias that Mr. Kimmons should have been able to demonstrate. With respect to what the state says is overwhelming evidence in this case, I would just note first that there was no proof of any accelerant was used in either fire at issue here. With respect to the witness, Ms. McMullen, who saw Mr. Kimmons, that's in volume 4 of the joint appendix. Her testimony is really interesting because he is throwing something on this fire, and it's water, because there was no trace of an accelerant. Nothing was found. So to the extent that he was throwing something, she said it was a jug and it was water, and that she went and they talked about how dangerous fires were, and she also went to go get water to put out the fire.
Counsel, can we go back to the statutory discussion again on the contiguous fire statute? What do you say to the state's argument that because the first and second degree arson is incorporated in the contiguous fire statute, that all that was required is that there had to be an intent to do harm, and that other structures are manifestly endangered by the setting of a fire?
I think a couple of interesting things about that. The first would be that in this case, then it would appear that contiguous fires would not apply because it was brush that was set on fire, which is third degree arson. That is not a second degree arson. To the extent that the state says that Ms. Noble referred to 205.045 is establishing liability for each structure, it would be really helpful if it used the word each. It does not. And if the legislature wants to correct that, would care to correct that, that would certainly be within the legislature's ilk, as is all public policy concerns related to fire and the danger thereof. I don't think you can read NRS 205, the 205045 without also looking at use of the word any person, which again implies more than one person and the possibility of joint and several liability. And given this ambiguity, given that there it does not, the statute does not clearly, when read together, state that there can be one count for each dwelling burned, Mr. Kimmons would submit that lenity requires that two of those counts of first-degree arson be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.